Good afternoon, everybody. We're here today for oral argument. We're going to call appeal numbers 25-1623 and 25-1818, Thomas versus Chicago Teachers Pension Fund. Ms. Akins, we'll recognize you. You may approach the lectern.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. What time it is? And may it please the court, this is Carla Akins on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant. This is our second time coming up to this court. The first time, Your Honors may be aware, with respect to the motion to dismiss that was filed at the outset. At this juncture, we're just asking that Mr. Thomas be permitted to proceed to a jury trial. In brief, I believe that the way that the local rule was interpreted and the case law that supports it does not support that you can just ignore evidence in light of Rule 56 that we did provide it. All the cases that have been decided on that point have basically come down to there was not actually opposing evidence. In this case, there was. We attached it. I don't think the rule is even that precise about the manner of attachment, but the vast majority of his argument, there's facts, were disregarded completely, and I think that runs contrary to Rule 56. And so that's the main thrust of the argument here. I think even with, in light of the way that the Seventh Circuit Supreme Court precedent goes in terms of a question of fact, this all goes down to credibility. And I think Tolan v. Cotton makes very clear, Anderson, Liberty Lobby, if it's based, and it's always based upon a belief that this is the reason. And so even if they're able to present facts to support that Mr. Thomas's discharge was in fact lawful or did not violate any laws, he's allowed to present evidence to rebut that, which he has done. There's pretext, there's clear evidence of pretext. I mean, the person who was chosen to be promoted over Mr. Thomas is the same person who called him the N-word in an exchange in the bathroom. So in terms of the promotions, in terms of the facts, the underlying facts themselves, Mr. Thomas was a no-brainer choice, according to Ms. Mallett, for the job. He knew the job. He's the one that had to basically train the people who ended up being selected over him because they didn't know the job. They didn't have the same background that he did. And even if there was an issue with respect to that, there's at least a question of fact with respect to whether or not he was qualified. That is a question of fact. I'm sorry, I wanted to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. I don't want to go on and on. I think that it's a pretty clear-cut case with respect to that. I don't think that there's any Seventh Circuit precedent that supports that. If you have facts to support your claims in dispute, that the court can basically issue a default judgment because of the manner in which the facts that you provided that were cited and supported were not in the manner that the court wanted to see. I don't think that that's the spirit of Rule 56. I definitely don't think that's the spirit of any of the Supreme Court precedent with respect to whether there's a question of fact. We can't just disregard it. And I want, one second, I'm sorry, we're having some technological difficulties, so I had to use my cell phone, I apologize. The Mark Cure case, I believe, makes that clear. And so we don't want to have, there should never be a dismissal on the merits of a case where there's clear factual disputes because of some type of a procedural issue with respect to consideration of facts where there's actual citations. I could understand, like I said, with respect to the other precedent, that if there is no citation or it's not supported or the court can't find in the record what we're talking about, then I understand that. But that's not what happened here. And basically, defendant was granted a default judgment as a result.
Is it your position, Ms. Akins, that the genuine issue of material fact that exists based on the evidence in the record is stronger for the race claim or the age claim?
I think it's both. You had all of the comparators that Mr. Thomas has, so with respect to them being younger, they were younger than him, all of them. But then I think they tried to use Ms. Katrina Cannon, who is African-American, but who is younger than him. So when you say stronger, all I say is that she's the one that fits in that category. everybody else, it's a race claim. And I think with respect to Ms. Mallett, who's basically saying, and just saying what he's saying, it was a no-brainer to have him in place of the people that you did, especially, I think, for a jury, if we're talking about a jury trial, is it compelling that you have to end up training? And this is something we see all the time, that you end up training the people that are supposed to be selected over you who are supposedly more qualified. And so when you say strength, I think the race claim is supported by maybe more evidence, but at summary judgment, we're talking about, do you have sufficient evidence to get past for a jury? And I think under both age and race, you have sufficient evidence. Now, with respect to the race, it's certainly more pervasive, right? Okay. Your own supervisor, it's not just a colleague, it's your own supervisor who's now supervising you, who got the job. Not only do you let him say this and nobody does anything about it, there's no investigation that he gets the job, and you are now reporting to him and having to deal with all the dynamics of this workplace. I think it was very clear that they were making these senior positions for African-American people who had been there for a period of time without actually giving them the roles like manager and titles such as that. And so I think from the totality of the circumstances standpoint, the race claim has more facts to support it because they did it with other people. Ms. Mallett, everyone else who could attest to the fact that they were doing, I think Ms. Cannon even herself said, you know, basically Mr. Thomas was qualified for this. No one knew more than he does about this. And that's actually what ends up, you know, being his demise, is because he and Mr. Aguilar, he's telling him, you know, you're not doing this correct, but they were also making him do these reconciliations. So this was his job. I mean, and then to tell him he doesn't know what he's talking about when he's the one that's training the same people on this, there's just so many disputes of fact. I just don't know how on the record, if you're actually looking at it in total, you would say he doesn't have a question that could be brought to a jury. I mean, I think the race situation is more problematic for CTPF because of how they handle all of the promotions of others. That's just been a thing that they've done, and certainly with respect to his. But I think they're both supported, both age and race. Sorry for the extended answer.
I appreciate it.
Did Mr. Thomas report the comments that Mr. Aguilar made to him?
I don't believe that he did so at the time. At some point he did. So when we first filed the first lawsuits that we started in the state court, he was still there. He was there through all of them, I think in 20, I don't want to get the date wrong, it was 21 or 22 when he was finally terminated. So there was plenty of opportunity for them to do something about it, even if they had only found out about it later on. At some point, the understanding...
Do you know when they found out about it?
I mean, what they admit to in terms of finding out about it, I don't know.
Client say? What does Mr. Thomas say as to when he reported it or how... Does he know the circumstances that led to the people in the company finding out about it?
When they had, I know that they had this meeting when they were talking about the issues, and he brought those things up. That's what I'm saying. That was before he got terminated, while we were already in litigation. So that had already come out because we had already filed the complaint and let them know about it. So again, there's always an opportunity to do something about it while he was still there. Also, everybody was talking about it, you know, with him. And so that was his, I'm not going to sit here and say that he reported it right away because he didn't. I think he was just so shocked and taken aback that happened. But at some point they do learn of it, obviously throughout the course of litigation. It's a little unusual because he continued to be, it happens. He continued to be employed there throughout litigation.
So, how long was he employed there? Do you know his date of separation?
I need to double check. I mean, it's in the record as 22. After the pandemic, the dates are getting a little muddled, but it's 6 or 7 years because he started in 2014 and then he came in permanently, I believe, 2015, and then through 2021 or 22. I can double check if you want me to, but I believe that's the.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah, and it's in there.
Where is he now, Thomas?
He's not working.
Okay. Thank
you. So, any other questions that I can answer?
Would you like to reserve the remainder of your time for rebuttal?
I would, yes.
Very good. Thank you
very
Zakins.
Much.
We'll now move to hear oral argument from the appellee. We'll go to Mr. Andrews.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Greg Andrews. I represent the defendant appellee, Chicago Teachers Pension Fund. There are four reasons why this court should affirm the decision of the district court. First, the district court did not abuse its discretion by striking Thomas's inclusion of additional facts in his response to CTPF's Local Rule 56.1 Statement of Facts, where those facts lacked record citation and record support. Second, a de novo review of the district court's grant of summary judgment in CTPF's favor on the record evidence shows that CTPF had a legitimate business reason for not promoting Thomas, suspending him, and ultimately terminating him. Third, the district court did not abuse its discretion in striking Thomas's Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, Rule 59E, motion to reconsider, for failure to follow Local Rule 5.3 and District Court Judge Coleman's standing order. Finally, the district court did not abuse its discretion when it awarded costs after granting summary judgment in favor of CTPF.
Moving to the second reason, Ms. Akins argues, isn't it contradictory to have someone who is being terminated as a result of a legitimate business reason then training the person who would succeed them?
It's not necessarily contradictory for someone to orient someone, and I think the reference is to Trevino. However, that's not in the record, Your Honor. So we're talking about a hypothetical, something that was not before the district court. And as we know from the Igasaki ruling, we cannot insert new facts into the record here today in the appellate court or in the appellate briefing. Turning to the Local Rule 56.1 failures by Thomas, there's four different ways that Thomas failed to follow Local Rule 56.1. First of all, including additional non-responsive facts in his response to CTPF's statement of material facts. This resulted in Judge Coleman striking 19 of those responses and leaving as deemed admitted 19 facts. The second way that Thomas failed to cite evidentiary material that was disputed, and he just didn't cite to anything. So the court did not abuse its discretion there in striking his response to paragraph number 47, for instance. And paragraph number 47 is significant because it's the one where CTPF says we had a legitimate business reason. It was its continued failure to produce these reports in a timely fashion and its continued arguing with Aguilar over how to do it, even though, as we heard from counsel earlier, he knew how to do it. He'd been doing it for a long time, but he began a campaign of email arguments with his supervisor. And he included Elise White and Carlton Lenore, the executive director, both of whom were within the same race and age categories as Thomas. He included them directly in these arguments. So they had direct knowledge of what Thomas was doing when he was continuing to argue with Aguilar. Third, the district court did not abuse its discretion when it struck Thomas's response to paragraphs number 12 and 29 because they improperly relied on hearsay. Fourth, the district court did not abuse its discretion when it struck Thomas's additional statement of material facts because he inserted it into his memo of law. Turning to the decision to grant summary judgment on the record, first, let's address the failure of Thomas to even bring up in his appellate briefing the Illinois Human Rights Act, other than in one heading. We don't see any argument regarding this issue of failure to exhaust administrative remedies. Thus, it's waived. But even if it weren't waived, Judge Coleman was right. The letter from the Illinois Department of Human Rights was not a right to sue letter, and it was not produced in discovery, and simply wasn't part of the record. So the district court was right there as well. The Illinois Human Rights Act counts, those are 1, 3, and 5, those are properly dismissed. Turning now to the de novo review of what is in the record, we see in the record that Thomas continued to argue with Aguilar, continued to fail to produce these reconciliations in a timely fashion, so much so that that even when he'd been suspended and gone on FMLA leave and he returns in July, and the date he was terminated, by the way, was August 8th of 2022, even when he returned, that work was still waiting for him. And he continued again his campaign of arguing with Aguilar and copying Elise White. All of that is deemed admitted and unrebutted. And even if we were to look at what was attempted to be introduced in the response by Thomas, there's nothing other than comments by co-workers, such as this Phyllis Mallett, who then later says, well, I didn't really know Trevino. I don't really have an opinion about him. So that doesn't help Thomas at all. So looking at a de novo review, Judge Coleman was correct at the district court to point to the fact that this continued failure to get these reports, these reconciliation reports, done on time, and this continued long-running email arguments with his boss about how to do the reconciliations was enough to say, look, you don't meet the second element of a prima facie case under McDonnell Douglas. You don't meet it under Ortiz either, because even if we just put it all in one big pile of facts, there's no fact that would go to reasonable jurors that would allow those jurors to say, oh, maybe we should stop. And let me address then this comment about the N-word, which was allegedly made in 2018. 2018 is a long way from 2022. We also have the fact that the decision makers, Elise White and Carlton Lennar, did their own independent investigation. They meet independently with Thomas and try to encourage him to get his work done. So this isn't some kind of a cat's paw argument, though that was never raised either and is thus waived. But even so, there's not enough for, even if we take at face value as we must for summary judgment, the allegation that the N-word was used, that's a stray remark. And we have ample cases in this court that say that stray remarks such as that are distant in time, not referring to the adverse decision in question, and even if they are made by the decision maker, those are stray remarks, and those are not evidence of discrimination. We have the Egemon case that we cite too, also quoting Hemsworth. We cite that in our brief, but we also have Brewer versus Board of Treasurers, a 2007 case. We have Island versus Trinity Hospital, Cohen versus Glenbrook Secretarial Services, 1997. We have Greer versus Medtronic, a 1996 case. Isolated comments must be contemporaneous with a discharge or causally related to the discharge decision-making process. And that's simply not the case here. So moving on then to the retaliation claim, it also falls for the same reason. There was a legitimate business reason. He was failing to get the reports in on time and continuing to argue. But in addition, there's another reason, that fourth element of the McDonnell-Douglas test, which Judge Coleman cites to but never has to get to. There is no comparator. There is simply no comparator. To say that Trevino, the man with the master's degree, is a comparator, simply not accurate. And to say that Aguilar is a comparator is also not accurate. Aguilar held the job before, the same job that Thomas did not get. So Thomas cannot say, well, I'm a comparator. He never held that job. So he's not a comparator. So under that fourth element of the McDonnell-Douglas test, there's no prima facie case. And even under Ortiz, there's just simply nothing there. If we just piled up all the facts to say, oh, here's one fact we could pull out, there's not enough for a reasonable juror to find in favor of Thomas. There's no genuine issue of material fact here. And as a matter of law, Chicago Teachers Pension Fund must prevail, and it was correct, even under this de novo review that we must go through, that on the record evidence, there's no evidence that would support Thomas's claims under the Illinois Human Rights Act or Title VII. Turning to the motion to strike, that was filed at midnight on the 28th day with no notice of hearing, as was required by Judge Coleman's standing order and Local Rule 5.3, which enables judges to have standing orders to manage their dockets. So the judge was right to strike it. As to the award of costs, Rule 5.3, there The court did not abuse its discretion because Rule 54 of Federal Rule of Civil Procedure states costs shall be allowed to the prevailing party. And the Nowoki case that we cite to states that we need only show that it was relevant at the time. Well, it's relevant at the time if it's Thomas who noticed them, other than Thomas's own depositions, and that would be the 11th deposition. Those were all relevant transcripts, and thus the award of costs to the prevailing party, Chicago Teachers Pension Fund, was appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll move now, Ms. Akins, to you for a rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. I mean, most of this is brief, so I'm not going to go over everything that we've already discussed, but their entire argument is form over substance. There's actual case law and rules that apply that allow for things like if you need more time, Rule 6, and there's an authority going through all of that, and they act like these things don't matter and just, you know, you're within your rights. We're talking about extinguishing somebody's right to a jury trial on highly disputed facts. I don't disagree that their people made these statements and claims and all that. There's nothing to show that they did it beyond them saying it. So a jury gets to decide if they believe them. I personally think that a jury could. I took these depositions. I was there listening to this testimony. I've been involved in this case from the beginning. I think there's more than enough for a jury to believe my client and not the people that they have giving this evidence. They've, from the beginning, motions to dismiss, like everything. They never want to deal with the merits. And that's a huge problem. That's why I cited the Hiddle case, because it's not just about, that's Justice Thomas saying, look, McDonnell Douglas was a bench trial. You've got Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Gorsuch, and himself, who people might not necessarily think, you know what, these are the people who have been proponents, even in their former circuit court days. There's case law that's in within Hiddle that cites to it. We've confused the standard. Everyone seems to be confused about what this is that we're supposed to be doing. Sure, having comparators is helpful. It's certainly a way to prove it, and we believe that we have those. But it's the inference of discrimination. That's what Reeves versus Sanderson is about. That's what all of this Supreme Court case law is about, Tolan v. Cotton. Now, they haven't, they didn't take Justice Thomas's recommendation to take up Hiddle, but in it, he's explaining why this is so troubling, because this was judicially made doctrine that everyone is interpreting in any way that they please to get the outcome that they want, is what it appears to be, and taking away people's constitutional right to a jury trial. Mr. Thomas, they can say what they want. Mr. Thomas disputes all of that. Whether these things were, people were actually qualified to say that we're in the middle of litigation about these specific issues, you find out about the comments from Mr. Aguilar, there's no investigation into any of that, and now because you didn't attach, you had additional argument and you didn't stick with what we put in our motion to dismiss your case, you can't bring up new facts and we're just going to completely disregard them because we didn't follow the narrative that you wanted us to follow. That cannot and should never be the law. The only thing that I am asking on behalf of Mr. Thomas is that he have his right to a jury trial and have the people actually decide if they believe all these things that are being said. I'm not going to say what I believe with respect to the credibility, but that's not anybody's job here. They could be credible, they could not. They could believe my client, he could lose. All of those things are possible. All I'm asking is that he have his day in court. There's no authority for completely striking motions and all this. This is all briefed. I don't want to go over it in too much detail, but there were times when it was enforced with respect to noticing a motion up. That cannot be the basis for not listening to the fact that, hey, let's see if we can get another opportunity to brief this in the way that you want, because I don't actually see in the rule where it says you have to attach this additional facts to this particular document. I don't think that it says that. And if that's the reason he does not get a jury trial, even in the Seventh Circuit and all the circuits where I practice, you get to redo your brief. You get to redo it once they tell you that something is wrong with it. And that's how it should be. It should not be that nobody can proceed on an appeal or no one can proceed on a summary judgment motion because somebody said that their facts weren't attached in the right way. they were included. That's what Rule 56 requires. Again, all the authority has to do with not actually having evidence to support what you're saying. That is not what we have here. And to actually ask the court to basically ignore all of the evidence to the contrary, basically that's what they're saying. Because of all of these technicalities, we should just ignore the evidence to the contrary that Mr. Thomas has. That cannot possibly be the right result. Even if he wanted to just have, I mean, we did dispute the facts in the facts that the defendant presented. We cited those. And then we also had additional facts. Even in what was there, this is a question, these are questions of fact. Qualification. Is that the real reason? That's credibility. That's judgment. You might have business judgment, but that does not defeat pretext. Because, yes, every defendant is going to have a reason, usually something that looks legitimate, right? They all get past that part. Then it goes back to the plaintiff, and what do you have to show that this is not the truth? All of this evidence, the fact that this man is calling you a racial slur, and nobody seems to care about that, regardless of when you happen to find out. And just for record, Honor, it was August of 2022. I did look that up, his termination. All of these things, they did not happen in a vacuum. All he's asking for is the ability for the people under the Constitution to be able to see the facts as they actually are. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Akins. Thank you, Mr. Andrews. The case will be taken under advisement.
Thank you.